to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Phantasmic Figures. I want you to imagine that it's Friday night and you're single and you've just had a date that went pretty well. And when I say pretty well, I mean it went well enough that you feel like there might be a date number two, maybe even tomorrow, maybe tomorrow it's Saturday afternoon, go for a walk or something, but not so well that that it's a sure thing. So the date's over, you go home and you think about what the other person might be doing. Maybe at first you think about them drafting a message to send you to arrange that second date. But then maybe you try not to get ahead of yourself and you start to think that maybe they've actually just, you know, gone and texted their ex because they didn't really enjoy the date that much, or they realize that they like their ex a lot more than they like you and they're ready to get back to them. Well, maybe it's neither of those things at all. Maybe they're doing something completely different that isn't even, that you're not even capable of thinking of. Well, my point the point of discussion, I guess, for today's episode is that sort of Schrodinger's cat situation where we project multiple versions of other people. So we try and think up all the different kinds of people that they might be in a given moment when we can't know what they're actually doing, when we can't see them in front of us. And we have to pretty much take a guess about how they, not only what they're doing, but how they feel about us. Hence why this week we're talking about phantasmic figures. So in general use, when we use the word phantasm, we talk about an appearance or like a picture or an image of something that kind of appears real. So it's a bit like a hologram or an illusion or a mirage or like a ghost, I suppose. But it lacks kind of material substance. We often associate things with an optical illusion or, as I said, like a hologram or something that you can't actually touch. And it's actually used in the worlds of, in psychology and philosophy, phantasm meaning a mental representation or image formed in the mind, which may or may not correspond to reality. It can refer to a subjective experience that has no external basis but is perceived as real by the individual. So we're talking specifically this week about phantasmic figures. So not just like a perceived version of an ice cream or something when you're getting hungry. Like we're talking specifically about when we have projected these versions of people that may or may not be real, or at least we can't know whether they're real or not. And we're going to start off looking at this, as we've started with our little scenario at the beginning there. We're going to start talking about this sort of in the romantic realm, like in terms of just like the most sort of fundamental relationships that people have been sort of loving, and romantic relationships probably where this probably has the most relevance maybe. But then we're going to pull it apart and look at and broaden it up a little bit and look at it sort of in more of a symbolic sense. And then we're kind of going to look at it in like a scientific one. And I'm really excited to talk about it this week because I think all the films are very different in one sense, sort of tonally. But they do all deal with this idea in really interesting and different ways. So the first one we're going to talk about is the romantic comedy from 2009, He's Just Not That Into You by Ken Kwapis. We're then going to move on to the new film, the new Australian film Run Rabbit Run by Dana Reid, which is currently, I think it's currently on Netflix. It was on at the Sydney Film Festival a couple of weeks ago. And then we're going to finish off with Iago Van Dormael's 2009 film starring Jared Leto, Mr. Nobody. But let's kick things off now with He's Just Not That Into You, I'm Sorry Girl. So basically, if you don't know this one, it's a series of interconnected love stories about people, mostly women, I suppose, who are sort of kind of lying to themselves about how much their respective partner actually likes them. And we see this cover the full gamut of romantic relationships, or better put, we see this play out in the full gamut of Jennifers. So we have the classic single dating girl who's just trying to find a boyfriend, and that's played by Jennifer Goodwin. Then we've then got the long-term relationship, but they're not quite married. That's Jennifer Aniston and Ben Affleck. And then we've got the married, but maybe he's cheating on me situation with Jennifer Connelly, and then a bunch of others that involve people who aren't called Jennifer, so I'm not going to worry about them. But I want to, we've talked about this a lot on the show. Sometimes we look at really artsy cinematic films, and then other times we look at basic action films, blockbuster films. This is a pretty, this is a sort of smushy 2009 rom-com you can get. It's got the very cliche soundtrack and score. It looks, you know, it's an easy watch. And I think it's important to talk about this one at the start of the show because when we have something that has that kind of mainstream, at those mainstream attributes, you know, the cliche rom-com, we're in the world of art, or if you, maybe you're a Scorsese, but you don't consider this art, but we're in the world of creative expression that is universally cathartic, right? The reason why these films make money, the reason why people go out and watch them in society is because we can all relate to kind of the base idea that's going on. And this film is a cathartic embrace of this universal experience of the cringiness and I suppose the frustration in thinking that someone is someone that they're not, particularly in the romantic realm. In other words, thinking that the person... the thinking about a person to be the person, the version of themselves that we desperately want them to be, but they probably aren't, or they straight up aren't. Hence why it's relevant to this when we talk about the idea of phantasm. So let's say you are that person that's gone on the date at the beginning of today's episode, and you have this idea that they are texting you back, but in reality, they're off getting with their ex. That would be a phantasm, wouldn't it? You are projecting or coming up with a fake version of a person that isn't actually real, but you perceive maybe through some element of wishful thinking, which we'll touch on a little bit more in a second, in order to get that. Now, I think it's really important, even though this is sort of just like a silly rom-com, this element of universality is depicted, I think, quite well in the film in that we've got all these characters who are all these different stages, and they're all interlinked, like a bit like... so like in a Robert Altman film or something like that. Like, you know, they all work together, or their brother or sister with somebody, and they all know each other. So we could see this film, and I want to, because I really want to smash this word, I really want to hone in on this word universality. We could say that what we're watching when we watch this film is actually the story of one couple, but we're seeing sort of all of their important stages in their romantic life simultaneously in the one movie, in the one moment. So we're sort of seeing the entire timeline of a relationship in one moment. A bit like, I think when we did the film Day Trippers, we talked about how you could look at that film the same way, and I think you can with this film too. And I think they even could have expanded to another character where... you know, it's not just in the romantic realm, but also in a friendship or in a professional relationship as well. We project a version of maybe a friend or a boss or something that we, you know, I really hope my boss really likes me. I really hope my friend really wants to hang out on Saturday, and we're thinking about them coming up with plans for us, but maybe they're actually off doing something completely different in the real world, and then we've got this fake version of them that we've come up with in our heads. But anyway, all this doesn't change the fact that the film makes you cringe very hard, right? That's sort of the main point, I think, of this film. And I certainly, I physically cringed in a particular scene in this film with Jennifer Connelly, if you've seen the film. Particularly, I guess, the Jennifer Goodwin character, she's kind of cute and adorable in her cringiness. But the Jennifer Connelly character, yeah, there's some serious cringing. You really do feel sorry for this kind of person. And it's extremely relatable. And people do go through these kinds of very cringy situations where they're trying to impress their given spouse or something like that. But it doesn't really, you know... I don't want to get into it too much if you haven't seen the film, but basically the fact that this is a very cringy thing in the mainstream world, human beings are instinctively find these false projections of whether someone likes you when they actually don't, is very cringy, and it's embarrassing if you do it. And I guess on a sort of a bottom line level, it's undesirable. In other words, that it's something that we want to avoid. It's perhaps a sense of or a sign of immaturity in the Jennifer Goodwin character. Context, and maybe in the Jennifer Connelly context, perhaps this an example of naivety, and simply just a product of very naive wishful thinking, just hoping that this guy is this perfect man when we maybe actually kind of deep down know that he isn't. And it's something, and I suppose when you watch these characters go through the torment and the torture of what they go through, you reflect on your own life and you say, I really don't want that to happen to me. I don't want that to be something that I put myself through. But should we always just simply dispose of these phantasmic figures that we come up with, that we conjure up in our heads? But before we try and answer that question, just remind you, I listen to 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio here on the People Powered Radio station. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming. And also jump onto our website, consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. But moving on now to the new film, Run, Rabbit, Run by Dana Reed. And this one stars Sarah Snook, who people would know from Succession. And she's looking after, she's a single mother looking after her daughter, Mia, who keeps kind of freaking her out because the daughter keeps calling herself Alice, which is Sarah's dead sister's name. It's kind of freaky. And then a whole bunch of crazy stuff happens. I've got to be really careful not to give too many spoilers away because this is a fairly new film. And a bunch of crazy stuff happens, which suggests that Mia kind of actually might actually be Alice, but she can't be because she's dead. And there's a very obvious tie in here with Sarah is like a gynecologist, I suppose. She's like a maternity doctor. So there's like a whole underpinning theme or motif of like, you know, bringing life, you know, the genesis of life thing. And also she herself is a mother. So there's a lot of motifs of, and also there's a rabbit, and rabbits are very often associated with fertility and, you know, breeding like rabbits, etc. I think that's a bit limiting. I think that the rabbit is more broad, and, you know, she's called Alice and going down the rabbit hole and all that stuff there. We're not going to have time to go through all the symbolism in this film because it is quite dense. I actually think what's really important when we talk about it this week, particularly because it's a new film and you haven't seen it, I think what's really important is that you watch this movie properly. I've seen a lot of reviews about this film, and I try not to read a lot of reviews and things before I talk about films because I want these sort of takes to stay sort of as original to the topics that we're talking about and try not to veer off into something, just into general comments about the film. But I have noticed that people are frustrated with this film because it maybe doesn't explain a lot of the stuff that happens in it. And, you know, a good horror film should have its own lore, its own internally. I reject all that. I actually really enjoyed this film. I found it extremely scary just on that level. But I think that the symbolism and the metaphor and the metaphors and all that sort of thing, extremely rich. We could talk about this film for 5 hours. We're going to hone in on the specific little ones. But I think when you watch a film like that, understand it's meant to be a metaphor, right? It's you don't have to have a consistent supernatural laws that are internally consistent and stable in and of themselves. So essentially, what the film is trying to do, it's giving us an analogy. And I think on a very basic and crude level, the analogy is that the experience of living with demons, which is what we find out Sarah is living with, and you find out that the death of her sister is a little bit dubious, actually, that the experience of living with demons, being haunted by your demons, is kind of akin to living as if your daughter, who is, you know, in blunt terms, the most valuable thing to you, the thing that, you know, is completely innocent and implicitly relies on you as its only protector in this world. It analogizes experiencing living with demons and making that akin to with living as if your daughter is possessed by the person that you betrayed in your past. That when you do someone wrong, they will come after the most valuable thing, the most innocent thing that you care about. And it's important that, you know, it happens at that age. We'll talk about in a second the idea of being reminded by someone, but our lives being tainted by our past, and the people, and more so than that, the people in our lives, the people that we affect, especially the people that rely on us the most, are very much affected by the things in our past that haven't been fully resolved. So it's very much a question around parenting and a film about mothering and making sure all of your stuff is settled before you bring someone into this world that's implicitly and inevitably reliant on you. I do want to say as well, it's really important that it's not simply the case that this haunting, this phantasm simply just possesses Mia, and but it's more that she goes sort of in and out. She kind of lives in her own body as well. You know, there's a separate actor that plays Alice and a separate actor that plays Mia, but Mia is sometimes Alice in the film. So as to say, in the only way that cinema can, that Sarah simultaneously distinguishes and conflates both of these figures. Now, that sentence in and of itself, you know, Sarah simultaneously distinguishing and conflating both Mia and Alice is an annoying sentence, I understand that, but it's a little bit like when you think about how someone reminds you of someone. Like, you know, when you meet a new person, you're like, oh, you remind me of my friend Frank. It's like, well, they're not Frank, but you're seeing Frank when you see them. But they're not Frank. But you can't help but think of Frank when you see their face. And I hate that I keep harping on about Derrida the last couple of weeks, but I think this is very, you can make a very interesting Derridean interpretation of this film, which is that Sarah's experience of Mia slash Alice is a constant question of who, you know, what is the actual difference between these two people? They're both present and absent in one another simultaneously, sort of at all moments. And that's kind of like, well, when we're in this realm of phantasm, when we think about, you know, that guy or the girl that we went on that date with, they're kind of, you know, in the Schrodinger's cat sense, they're both alive and dead at the same time. That person is both them and not them. We can't actually know in that moment. We can distinguish two separate bodies, two separate actors, but they're kind of each other. They're molded and they're going in and out of actually being the same person. So we did establish, you know, when we talked about the first film this week, he's not that into you. He's not that much. He's just not that much into you. And we established the idea that it can be a very immature or naive thing, you know, and simply just a symptom of wishful thinking to come up with these phantasmic figures, just because we just want that to be real, and it's just easier than going through all the hard work and everything. It comes from a place of wishful thinking. But even in this film, what we see is that phantasmic figures can arise even when it is certainly not in the perceiver's interest, right? Because, you know, Jennifer Goodwin wants the guy that she's going after to be a guy that likes her back. In this case, Sarah doesn't want her daughter to be, you know, a demon from her past. She wants her daughter to have a nice little life. It's the worst thing that can happen to her, but she can't help but, if we understand this film to be a metaphor, she can't help but perceive the demons of her past within her daughter. She doesn't want it to be the case, but she can't help seeing that and feeling that guilt when she looks into her own daughter's eyes. So that's almost to say that there is this, going back last, similar to what we said last week, we're in the world of extremes. If even Sarah Snook's character, right, the one person in the world, the last person in the world that would want to perceive her dead sister in her daughter's face, right, if the last person in the world that would want that still experiences that, still undergoes that, that sort of says that we're all kind of subject to this phenomena of seeing the demons of our past or phantasms that we don't want to see in people when we look at them. And you can think about people in your own life. I'm sure there's times all the time where you have a sort of a prejudicial view about someone that you wish you didn't have. You wish you didn't see someone that you hate in someone that you love and vice versa, particularly in the opposite way. It's very often the case where we kind of love people we know that we shouldn't like. That happens all the time. So as to say that it's kind of like an instinctive inevitability that human beings do this. And I don't want to give too much away because a lot of the listeners probably haven't seen Run, Rabbit, Run yet, but the sort of when we conjure up these phantasmic figures, sometimes those phantasmic figures can actually lead that real person to a very undesirable place. So it's not only that it's something that we don't want, but we don't want it because it's leading to very bad outcomes. So even if it's going to lead to kind of the worst outcome for someone that we really love, we still do it, even if that process is going to have negative outcomes. If we, you know, even if we know that projecting someone that we imagine, you know, a bit like when you say to someone's face that they could be someone that they know that you don't like, or they could be a version of themselves that they don't want to be, it makes them upset. It can lead to some kind of downward spiral in their own development. And we know that we shouldn't do it. We know it's going to be a bad thing, but we can't help but do it. I mean, you could say, listen, Jimmy, this is all a bunch of mumbo jumbo at this point now. You're saying that people are both this thing, they're both that thing. Look, I've never seen someone with two faces all at once. Let's get real. Let's get scientific. Well, maybe it is possible that phantasmic figures are real in a sense. Well, to sort of answer that question, let's move into our third and final film. It's Mr. Nobody from 2009, directed by Jaco van Dormael. And if you haven't seen this one, there's kind of two major plot points I think are worth touching on. The first is the Jared Leto character. He's the protagonist. He plays Nemo Nobody. And if you know, Nemo means nobody. So his name is Nobody Nobody. He's Nobody Squared, right? And he is the last mortal person. It's in the future, and everyone's become immortal, and he's the last mortal person. And then throughout the film, we kind of see, it's a very non-linear film, and we see various derivations of his core self. And I've been very deliberate in using the word derivation rather than iteration, because they all kind of look the same. They all resemble this core version of who he was when he was a 9-year-old boy or something, or 3-year-old boy or whatever, baby, something with babies and angels or something. But I don't mean that in a negative way. I really enjoyed this film. But they're derivations. They all resemble a core foundational element, but they all appear differently and have different lives. And so they're all pretty much, I guess all these different derivations are kind of subject to who he decided to go with when he was a young boy and his mum was leaving on a train and his dad was staying on the platform. And that's kind of the core plot point of the whole film. It's a very, you know, it goes into the questions around like the butterfly effect, but we'll touch on that in a second, about, you know, what would happen if you went with this person versus this person? How would your life be different? Now, to hone in on some of the key themes, the first point, the fact that he's the last mortal, well, let's take that word first, the last one. So the fact that he's the last one, I think it can be helpful to look at this film as if he's a condensed character that represents all mortal humanity, because he's the last one. It's like a concept of singularity. He sort of represents what it is to be a mortal human. And then this question of mortality, like, why is this even part of this story? And I thought about this for a long time, actually. And the more I thought about it, the more I feel like it's like, it kind of seems obvious, but like the human condition, at least at this point in history, is very much characterized by the fact that we have finite time. And time's a very important theme or concept in this film. And because we have finite time, it means that it creates imperatives, right? The choices we make are really important, right? We have to choose at a given time because we don't have an infinite amount of time. The choices we make will mean that we necessarily can't do certain things in this world. If you compare that with an immortal being, right, there are no imperatives to do anything, right? Your choices actually don't matter. Your choices do not matter because if you make a good choice, or if you don't make a good choice, you can always make a good choice, right? That choice is always available to you. You'll live for another 200 billion years. You can go make that choice another time. Choosing chocolate or vanilla, you can have both, right? And similarly, even if you do a bad thing, right, even if you do take the wrong choice, it doesn't matter. You'll always have enough time to make up for the mess that you made. People will always forgive you because you'll always be able to, you'll always have enough time to make up for it. So this is our first sort of introduction to this concept of time in the film, which I think was saying that being human involves, you know, there are imperatives. You have to make deliberate choices. There is a tragedy. There is a tragic element to being human, which is that when you make a choice, you inevitably denying yourself another choice, another way of living. And if we now combine that with this other major element of this film, which is the multiple derivations of this core character, it's a little bit trippy and confusing. And you could say, well, even say it's a little bit annoying that like we keep jumping between all these characters in the film, and you kind of have no idea where you are for the most part of this film, and you kind of, you know, you're a bit unsure like what's actually going on. But we do come to realize that it's really quite a simple story, and it's simply just a question of time. Now, of course, if we think about ourselves and in anyone in our lives in the present moment, right now, as I'm speaking to you, think of someone, right? Even yourself, or think of your best friend or something. They are just one person right now. Like in this moment right now, they are just one person. And the same also goes when we think about someone in the past, right? Because, you know, things have happened. They've already happened. You can't redo them. You can't, you know, if someone won a game of handball, they did not win that game. They did. That happened. That's a singular person in that. It's a singular linear string that goes straight to that person. And there's a lot of discussion in this film about, you know, why we can remember the past but not the future. And this is really a conversation around entropy, which is a very complex scientific concept. But I suppose in entropy kind of means like the direction or the orientation of time, in that it goes forwards and not backwards, or it doesn't stand still. And they go very deeply into the effects of, well, the concept of emergent properties, which is another way of saying that as time goes on, there's an irreversibility, or there's an inevitability of complexity, of chaos, of dissipation. And they use lots of different examples, like stirring mashed potatoes or smoke coming out of a cigarette, that as time progresses, things get more complicated. If you look at the world, it was a very simple thing, and as time takes its place, so if you think about, like, you know, the development of a river or any natural landform, all things become more and more complicated as time moves on and on and on and on and on and on. So complicated they become uniform in their complexity, you could even say. So this leads us to think about the future. And so when we have ideas about what a person might become, and we can never really know who they are, this starts to, you know, it's different to when we think about a person in the present or a person in the past. They are just single, but when we think about someone in the future, because we can't actually know who they're going to be, they are a multitude. The future self, or the future version of a person, is actually many people all at once. Because, you know, the impact of even the smallest choice, you know, this is the butterfly effect thing, and we see lots of examples in this, the motif of a slipping on a leaf or a little eggshell, or the big one is, you know, which train does he catch? That the most seemingly insignificant thing can have the most profound outcome. And this is very Everything Everywhere All at Once talked about this as well. So, like, and if you think about it, like, if you think about the tiniest little thing that can change everything, and the fact that there are so many tiny little things that can happen in a given life, you know, me touching this table right now or going blah, 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 right now, every little thing is going to have an impact. So if you think about all the different choices you have, there's so many different people that could exist, right? So in this moment, we think about a future version of someone. They are actually an infinite amount of people all at once. It's just a matter of us thinking about them now and not waiting a few years and then thinking about them in that time. It's simply a question or simply a matter of when in time we are thinking about them and when in time they are when we're thinking about them. But what does this mean for our everyday choices, right? We started with a very basic, relatable situation. Maybe we should go back to this date situation that we had, right? So at the start of today's episode, we talked about how it's a very cringy and potentially pathetic thing to project a false persona onto someone, particularly when the existence of that false persona, that phantasm, would make our lives better. And it's kind of cringy and a little bit naive and immature to think, you know, this person really does like me. And it's like, no, come on, don't be a goose. Like, you're just being wishful. That's just blind wishful thinking. But even if it's something that we really don't want to do, and even if it's something that's going to make our lives worse and make the lives worth of the person that we're projecting this onto, we can't help but do it, which sort of suggests that coming up with all these phantasmic figures is kind of, it's not just a symptom of wishful thinking or naivety, but it's also like an instinctive side effect or just a fundamental flaw in the human species. We can't help project false versions of people onto them or thinking about them. But what is annoying about this is that, you know, two people can't really be two people all at once. We can't just assume that people are a multiplicity of different people every time. We wouldn't get anything done. We wouldn't know who to refer to. We wouldn't know how to call someone Mia or Alice, right, when we have a conversation with them. But if we do adjust the temporal element of everything, right, if we stop thinking about people in the present and change, you know, are we thinking about people in the present or the past or the future? If we are a little bit more careful of the temporal element in all of this, and we sort of try and think about it in a way that's consistent with the laws of physics, we can see that people can actually have multiple personas simultaneously, but it's simply just a matter of when in time they exist in relation to us when we're thinking about them, right? So rather than catching ourselves, you know, out when we're projecting versions of someone, that, you know, these false versions of other people, or even a false version of ourselves, but perhaps instead of bashing ourselves and getting frustrated with ourselves when we do this, perhaps we need to focus more on our actual choices in that moment and the significant outcomes that will emerge once entropy or time takes hold of these seemingly insignificant choices that we have in front of us. So going back to our original scenario, maybe it isn't a question of whether that person is a phantasm, whether that person is into you or not. Maybe it's really a question of time. Maybe it's a question of when would they be into you? Well, that's all I've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM, people-powered radio. Please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, or jump into our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. We'd love it if you do all of that. Also, get in touch with me. You can email me at contact@jimbernasconi.com. If you've got any feedback or any ideas or recommendations for films that we should do, I would love to hear from you. Have a good one. See you next week.